Welcome to the Christian Life Commission's Conference on Biomedical Ethics. Those of you who are visitors to our city have probably already discovered that Nashville has more music and in the air and more Southern Baptists on the streets than almost anywhere. But we're glad you've come, and we hope you have a chance to hear some music and meet some Baptists. But we have not come here for fun and games. Rather, we have come here to consider some complex biomedical issues which require most careful attention. It is said that an airplane pilot addressed his passengers as follows. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is your pilot speaking. We are flying at an altitude of 35,000 feet and a speed of 700 miles per hour. I have two pieces of news to report, one bad and one good. The bad news is that we're lost. The good news is that we're making very good time. Now, some would say that this announcement describes precisely the situation related to biomedical ethics. They say we are already lost, and we are still moving very fast. This conference has been planned in the belief that this need not be the case. It is easy to get lost in a maze of biomedical issues. Events are developing almost too rapidly to keep up with, but the situation is not hopeless. There are resources in the Christian community to help us deal with these biomedical issues. Our purpose in this conference is threefold. In the first place, we have come to affirm that Christianity is a religion that speaks to all the issues of life. Nothing is outside the scope of Christian truth. All truth is Christ's truth. Biomedical issues require information and insights from many disciplines. But we can begin by saying that Christianity provides both wisdom and motivation to deal with these biomedical issues. Some people would say that Christianity has nothing to do with biomedical ethics. They would argue that these are medical, biological, genetic problems. Such a view of life is too narrow, too provincial, too isolated from the wholeness of reality. It fails to take into account the need for an interdisciplinary approach to these issues. Such a view fails to understand that not everything that is scientifically possible is morally responsible. On the other hand, there are those that say that theology provides all we need to face these issues. These people cite a scripture text and rush off, leaving the doctor, the nurse, the biologist, the geneticist, to struggle with the problems. Such behavior is actually a violation of the biblical insight that we are to work with God in caring for creation, and that we are to use all possible resources to find solution to these problems. Therefore, one purpose of this conference is to bring together insights from Christianity and the sciences. It is our intention to relate Christian ethics to these crucial issues for which there are no easy answers. The matters we will talk about are controversial. There will be differences of opinion. But remember that underlying all our discussion here is a unity based on the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. The second purpose of this conference is to identify some of the crucial problems related to biomedical ethics. We will seek to raise the right questions about some of the great issues of life. There are many matters which clamor for our attention in society, but biomedical ethics deserves special attention at this time. Let's face it, the church needs to give more attention to biomedical ethics. We have neglected these issues. They are tough. They are complex. They sometimes are gray instead of black or white. There are few precedents for some of the decisions that have to be made. So we are gathered here to ask the right questions and identify the right issues which must be faced. The final purpose of our coming together is to bear witness to the fact that the church can get involved in helping people find solutions to these problems. The church must provide resources to help the overworked nurse care for a dying patient, to help the troubled geneticist who struggles with the complexities of genetic screening, to help doctors who are trying to decide which patients to select for chronic dialysis treatment, to help biologists who wonder whether their experiments will take them, where their experience will take them and the human race, to help ministers to deal with the ambiguity and complexity involved in helping people make decisions about biomedical issues. This conference will end Friday afternoon, but it is a deep hope of Dr. Foy Valentine and the entire Christian Life Commission that the concern and energy and ideas invested in this conference will live on in a variety of ways. Let us gather here and grapple with these issues. Let us seek to sensitize people to them. And let us seek to work together in the days ahead to help Southern Baptists and others throughout the Christian community give attention to biomedical ethics. Dag Hammarskjöld once said, "The road to holiness passes through the world of action." Let us recognize our need to think creatively and then to act responsibly in applying the gospel of Jesus Christ to the great issues involved in biomedical ethics. Now you will see the program, printed program, which you have in your packet. We have a full day today and tomorrow. We will structure this conference in such a way that there will be a presentation made by each speaker, and then there will be 30 minutes or so for discussion and dialogue with the speaker. In addition, we'll have a panel discussion tonight where there can be further input related to the issues that are going to be raised. So we hope this will be a time not only to hear ideas from others, but for you who come from a variety of professions and from various parts of the country to have the opportunity to dialogue about these issues. I'd like to introduce some of the staff members of the Christian Life Commission at this time, if I may. Dr. Foy Valentine is the Executive Secretary of the Christian Life Commission. He is in Texas, and he sends his greetings to you and his prayers for a meaningful conference on biomedical issues. Mr. Floyd Craig is Director of Public Relations. Floyd, would you stand? Floyd and other staff members will be presiding throughout today and tomorrow. Welton Gaddy is Director of Christian Citizenship Development. Welton is at the door back there. David Sapp, a new staff member of the Christian Life Commission, is Director of Organization. David. And John Wood is Director of Program Development. This is also a new staff member of the Christian Life Commission. In fact, the moving van pulled up at the house that he's just purchased this morning. He was wise enough to come to this conference today. If you have any questions, if you'll see one of the staff members of the commission whom I've introduced or others, we will seek to answer them for you. There will be a message board right outside in the hall. This conference has grown and grown, and there are not enough parking places. And we've listed in the packet there some parking lots nearby, and we hope you're able to find your way to these. If you have any questions, we will certainly be glad to try to answer them. Our first speaker this morning is Dr. Daniel McGee. Dr. McGee is presently Associate Professor of Religion and Environmental Studies at Baylor University. Dr. McGee was educated at Furman University, Southeastern Seminary, and at Duke University, where he received the Ph.D. degree in 1966. Dr. McGee has taught at Southeastern Seminary and also has been professor at Meredith College. Dr. McGee is a gifted teacher. He's a teacher with whom the students identify and to whom they come up to year after year share with him what they're doing as they go out into the world. He is known as a gifted teacher. He's very active in religious and professional societies, having been an officer and board member of the American Academy of Religion and serving also as an officer in American Association of University Professors. He has written widely in the field of biomedical ethics and is something of a pioneer among Southern Baptists in dealing with these issues. Dr. McGee is an active churchman. He has served as interim pastor of a church in Waco for 3 years, which is longer than some full-time pastors have served. But he's very active in his community. He's very active in the church affairs. Today is Dr. McGee's 20th wedding anniversary. He flew his own plane up here yesterday from Waco, trying to avoid the storms as he came along the way. And when he finishes making this address this morning, he's going to fly his own plane back to Waco to to avoid the storm that would come if he wasn't at home on his 20th wedding anniversary. We're glad he's here, and we look forward to his address this morning as he comes to speak to us on the Christian and biomedical decision-making. Dr. Daniel McGee.
Thank you, Harry. I'm happy to be here and to see a number of you that I've known through the years and to share in this conference with you and to meet others of you, to share in dealing with, as Harry said, a very crucial issue or set of issues. Harry suggested that John Wood has a very good reason not to be at home today. The moving van's there, and as he explained, I have a very good reason to be at home. And so I do apologize for having to leave, because I really think the value of this conference will be the continuing conversation that I anticipate will build as you hear different presentations and as you begin discussing these issues with each other. I'm a bit frustrated by my own presentation this morning. The task of trying to look at this entire field and to answer the question, what does the Christian faith have to say to the questions being raised there? This task has been frustrating for me. As a result, what I have prepared, I'm not satisfied with. There's not enough specificity, not enough illustrations of how we would apply these insights to particular areas. It's something like a new phenomenon I was introduced to when I moved to Texas, and that is beef jerky. I'm not sure it's any good until you've chewed on it for a long, long time. And so that's what I invite you to do, is that we engage with each other in a communal chew-in and chew on these ideas. We'll spit some of them out, and maybe through it all we'll get a little bit of nourishment. That's my hope. And that's why I plan for us to have adequate time for discussion. So I invite you to listen carefully and critically and to start chewing, and then when I finish in a little while, let's chew together. I'd like to hear what you have to say and your responses. Astonishment, fear, gratitude, questions. These are the consequences we've experienced as we have encountered modern medical technology and practice. From the control of human reproduction to the management of the dying process, we've watched very familiar landscapes and practices altered radically. Abortion, genetic modification, gender selection, behavior modification, cloning, organ transplants, artificial insemination, prolongation of life. These are some of the examples of practices that have alternately created optimistic astonishment and fearful anxiety in the souls of contemporary humanity. These hopes and these fears are reflected in large measure by the recurring questions growing out of these practices. And I want to focus on five questions that I hear being asked, especially those questions being asked within the church. And those questions are, shall we play God? What guidelines should we follow? How do we define human life? Who shall decide? And finally, what shall we do first? These are the questions And I want us to examine and to reflect on the answers to these questions suggested by the Christian faith. First, shall we play God? Our recent and tragic experience with the Philadelphia Legionnaires is one of just many reminders that we are not gods. We are not all-knowing. We are not all-powerful. We are not morally perfect. Like all humankind of all generations, past, present, or future, we see through a glass darkly. Even our best efforts are always marred by our own corruptions, our own weaknesses, our own ignorance. But does this mean then that we fold our tents and steal away to a quiet land of passive contemplation? Do we fold our hands in the belief that because we're not perfect, it's all in God's hands, or it's all in nature's hands, or the hands of an all-powerful technological advance? I would insist the Christian faith says no. The Christian faith affirms that humankind's role in the making of history is not the role of a spectator. We are called by God to be participants in the making of history, co-workers with God, to accomplish that good which God wills and which God works toward. In medicine, we've been cursed by a religious view that some have called the God of the Gaps theology. This view holds that all areas of life that are beyond human understanding or control comprises God's territory. And then our territory is that area we understand and control. So the world is immediately divided into the turf on which God plays and the turf on which we play. If you begin with this perspective, it then appears that every new human venture is an assault upon the Godhead, a usurpation of God's prerogative. Thus, we hear such appealing, but I contend inaccurate cries, only God decides when a person dies. Only God creates life. The truth is that from the very beginning of creation, God called us to be co-creators, co-preservers of human life. The only difference today, and I acknowledge it is a dramatic difference, the only difference today, though, is that our capacities for controlling life have greatly increased. How do we respond to that one change? In Christ, God confronted mankind with new challenges and new demands. That Christ said to those who listened to stop burying their talents and to invest them. He said to stop putting your light under a bushel, exposing. He told them to leave the settled ways of their homes and their work and their traditions and to follow him into new lands and into new tasks. When John the Baptist inquired about this strange new ministry he'd heard of, Christ replied, "Go and tell John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive their sight. the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have good news preached to them, and blessed is he who takes no offense in me. Christ invited those who heard and who saw what he was doing to follow him and to take no offense in his healing, but rather to join him in that ministry. We have the same invitation today. Christ calls us to be faithful stewards, using responsibly that with which we have been entrusted. We stand today a generation remarkably endowed with capacities and opportunities only dreamed of in the past. The typical image of the country doctor of yesteryear was of one who frequently stepped back from the bed and said, "Well, it's in God's hands now." The typical image of the contemporary physician is of one whose bag and hands are filled with unbelievable array of tools and techniques. We are God's stewards, having our hands filled with both frightening and exhilarating responsibilities. The responsibilities of managing the benefits that the master of the household intends for his family. We have been entrusted with the miracles of modern medicine. There are two ways a steward can fail. One is to avoid responsibility. To say, "Well, it's not in my hands. It's not my business." The other is to misuse those gifts, those opportunities. It's the possibility of this second mistake that we turn to with the second question. What guidelines shall we follow? If we are to be participants in and not just spectators of history, then we must consider the rules or guidelines by which we participate. The steward can be faithless by diverting the master's resources to goals and purposes other than the master's. The biblical tradition describes this sinful tendency of those of us who have been blessed. In Deuteronomy chapters 8 and 9 is found two false explanations by God's elect for how it is that they are so fortunate to possess the promised land. First, in chapter 8, they claim that it is by their own might that this possession has occurred. They are self-made men, constantly astonished by their own brilliance and achievements. The second explanation, found in chapter 9, attributes their possessions to their own righteousness. It is their moral superiority that has earned them this good fortune and this favor from God. The biblical faith rejects explicitly these explanations with the claim that all good gifts come from God. In the heady excitement of the truly miraculous achievements in medical technology, we are tempted to explain it all by self-indulgent praise of our own brilliance or goodness. We then use these claims to create the myth that we are our own master, owing nothing to anyone, and therefore free to do with our capacities and resources whatever we will. On occasions, we might create new jobs, new gods in our own image, and then serve those new gods. Some have done this with science or technology, willing to let science or technology take their own course. Thus, if it can be done, it should be done. The Christian faith points to a very different explanation and a different behavior. The God revealed in Christ is the Master. Not ourselves, not our traditions, not our science, not our medical technology. Therefore, we are responsible to make this technology serve the will of God. In describing God's will, we describe the purpose we are to make our medicine serve. In the biblical tradition, God's will is defined in terms of God's action. God's will is not hidden from us, but is revealed in the acts of God as witnessed to in our tradition. I'm prepared to acknowledge that the acts of God are rich in their diversity and often disputed in their interpretations. But we must and can sketch the major features of God's will and let that serve as our guideline for our behavior. The profile of God's activity that comes through to me most clearly is of a God who is obsessed with one thing. A God obsessed with giving life and life more abundantly to all of his children. I see a God who in creation is pictured as working to create a life, a community, an environment that would provide the richest and most rewarding experience possible for his children, humankind. This is the same God who in Christ showed himself by serving whatever human needs he encountered. I see a God who says to his stewards, "You make my medicine serve human needs and nothing else." The temptation is for technology to serve itself, for medical institutions to serve themselves, for medical professionals to serve their professional advancement, for research to serve research, for social, medical, and even religious customs to serve only themselves. When this happens, we must be jerked back to the vision of a Christ who, when challenged for healing on the Sabbath, healing in a way we've never done before, healing on that day that is set aside for only God to act, when challenged for healing on the Sabbath, he answered, "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath." Medicine was made to serve human need and not vice versa. Medicine, hospitals, research, medical procedures, moral guidelines are made for serving humankind. They, like the Sabbath, are all gifts from God to serve humanity. The third question. How do we define human life then? If we have a vision of a God compulsively serving human life, then how do we define that human life? How do we identify it and its needs? Now, the attempt to define human life is ancient. The success of such attempts is very questionable. However, even recognizing both the difficulty and the dangers involved, it seems to me important that Christians examine their tradition or insights as to what qualities or features of human life are to be served. I would suggest in the beginning that our bodies or our biological vitality is a genuine part of the humanity God created and loves. The creation story in Genesis 2 pictures God as creating a body, breathing into it life, the total result of which was a soul. The notion of a radical dualism between body and spirit is a Greek notion alien to the biblical tradition. The early Christian response with the doctrine of the bodily resurrection reflects this perception that a part of our real humanity, our real self, our soul, is our bodies. This means that if I love you, I must concern myself with what we have unfortunately categorized as your physical needs. The ministry to the medical needs of God's children needs to be as crucial a concern for the contemporary church as it was for Jesus Christ. And I invite you to go through the gospel sometime and just add up the times you catch Christ healing. Also, if our humanity is bodily, that's a legitimate part of who we are as creatures of God, then we must acknowledge that we are limited in terms of time, space, and power. We then would never pretend that we have unlimited capacities, nor, I would argue, should we curse our limitations and dream of some technological Eden when we will have overcome our limitations. They are a part of who we are, to be accepted and to be appreciated. Finally, we should respect the biological order and system that is a part of who we are. Now, this is not calling for a letting nature take its course, as we'll see in a moment. However, those who treat, for example, our genetic tradition as if it were void of purpose, needing to be radically reordered in order to make us human, fail to appreciate what has been given to us as a part of our humanity in the biological order. Now, is that all that can be said about how God has created us? I think not. There's been a tendency of the Catholic tradition to stop there and to define human life in terms of the most minimal biological vitality. So if you've got a fertilized egg and that that vitality going. You got a human. I think that we cannot stop there. I think the Christian tradition does not stop there. If we did, then the distinction between humankind and the rest of the biological order would be slight indeed. God has created us with a freedom and individuality that comprises an essential part of our humanity. God created man in his own image. That is, God created us with a will of our own that gives us the awesome capacity to participate meaningfully in shaping our lives and our future. Thus, if I love you, I will respect that individuality and that freedom God has given only you. I will acknowledge that you are different from me, and I will defend to the end your right to retain that difference. I am concerned about many of the proposals in modern medicine, especially in genetic and behavior modification, that fail to value the diversity of humanity. They would eliminate all the weirdos. What concerns me is that you all look weird. And I have the sneaking suspicion that I look weird to you. Diversity and individuality is essential to the humanity God created. I do not mean that there's no place for modification. What concerns me are the purposes to which some would direct these efforts. They would direct them toward the creation of a kind of sameness that flies directly in the face of the marvelous diversity of weirdos God has created. Great care must be taken to preserve our freedom and diversity, because that's how God intended us. We should also remember this as we consider the purposes and results of medical experimentation, gender determination, cloning, prolongation of life. We must always consider human freedom if we're to emulate the creative God who gave that freedom to all of us as a distinctive part of humanity. But God created us not only in freedom, but also in community. To be human is to be in community with others. Again, the creation stories of Genesis 1 and 2 instruct us. In chapter 2, God's creation is not complete with that lone ranger, Adam. There must be two in community, complementing and fulfilling each other. That's God's vision of us. The entire biblical story, I would argue, can be read as God's attempt to reconcile the diverse segments of the humanity that he had originally created to be in constant community. An unbroken community in which individuals complete each other's humanity. See, I'm not complete till I have you. To be human is to be social. Here we see that contrary to popular belief, our individuality and our sociality are not contradictory. You must have both, or you have neither. The only way to have community, the biblical vision of community, is to begin with unique individuals. The only way unique individuals can realize their full humanity is to have others to complement them. All right, if that is something of the view of human life that we're to serve, then who shall decide? Well, the last thing I said about the communal nature of humankind gets us started in answering that question. Who's going to decide? Who decides if and when to pull the plug? Who decides if and when to abort? Who decides if and when and in what way to modify behavior? Who decides which patient receives that scarce organ or transplant? Who decides? Physician? Patient? The family? The insurance company? The preacher? The hospital administrator? The legislature? Now, while I acknowledge that the immediate locus of decision-making may shift from one situation to another, the crucial truth is that all of our decision-making must be communal. There's no longer enough room in the world for lone rangers. No single person, no single group has the wisdom to establish itself as the decision maker. As we have become specialized vocationally, we have become less informed generally, and therefore more dependent upon each other. It's an amazing truth that many have missed about the modern world. One of the greatest truths about what has been happening to us is that we have become more interdependent, more in need of one another, because we've become more specialized individuals. We must be driven to that kind of cooperative effort that is visualized in Paul's beautiful description of the human community in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 4 through 26, where he describes the human community God wants as being like a body in which the various organs are in a symbiotic, cooperative effort one with the other. There, no one organ pretends to be the whole body. The eye doesn't say, hey, look at me. I'm the whole body. I don't need feet. In medicine, the issues are too complex and too important for just the physicians to decide. Indeed, most of them recognize this. There are factors, such as social factors, to name only one, that escape the view of the physician when attention is concentrated by him upon the medical factors. Certainly, no one removed from medicine, such as a theologian, can provide definitive decisions. Each of us alone is inadequate. Thus, we must develop procedures that deliberately secure input from as many sources of insight as possible. This includes all of those people mentioned above, plus such people as social workers, economists, lawyers, nurses, all members of the healthcare team. Now, this process requires compromising, a dirty word for some. But I would contend that without a cooperative give and take, there can be no human community as God willed it. Those who have criticized the notion of compromising have often, in the process of compromising, have often said that the camel is a horse created by a committee. You've heard that. But I'll tell you right now, I'll take that compromised camel any day over the stubborn donkey, and I use the most polite term possible, the most stubborn donkey who insists that the whole world yield to his own idiosyncrasies. We must be prepared to learn from others, to acknowledge that I do not have all the answers, and that maybe the best thing we can do in that situation is to get together and work it out. Now, there is a special problem in dealing with the question of who shall decide that Christians face in a pluralistic society. We as Christians can never assume that the state exists to enforce the moral conscience of the church upon a pluralistic society. That should be most obvious to Baptists with their tradition on separation of church and state. You and I must make a clear distinction between that behavior which you and I as Christians would defend as moral and that behavior that we are prepared to enforce upon everyone by the power of the state. Those are two different questions and must always be distinguished. As an example, I would suggest that this is a crucial distinction that has not been made in much of the debate on abortion. All right, after who shall decide, one final question. What shall we do first? With the plethora of issues and responsibilities that confront us in bioethics, where do we begin? Well, of course, the truth is that as in real life, you begin everywhere at once. We have to. None of these responsibilities can really be avoided. They must be dealt with. However, we are responsible for establishing some priorities. One of our basic responsibilities is to determine which of those human needs should receive priority attention. I'm bothered by the fact that we have tended to follow the headlines, the dramatic, the unusual, the esoteric, the futuristic. It may be that the greatest need lies elsewhere. The common and therefore forgotten needs of our brothers are the ones that demand attention first. The truth is that the greatest health hazard in the world today, is inadequate food. Astonishing, isn't it? Not organ transplants, not chemotherapy, not psychotherapy, not psychosurgery, but food is the health need that touches more of the human race than any other. In deciding what we do first, it is important to remember that as you and I debate genetic modification to increase the IQ of future generations, as we debate that, there are people, I would guess, within a few blocks of this building whose children today are retarded because of insufficient protein in their diets. A Of course, there's a reason for us to fix our attention upon the unusual and the futuristic. Because if we focus our attention there, we don't have to do anything about that but talk. The immediate and the common demand action now. Christ shows us the way. When he went to the hospital ward at the Pool of Bethesda, he healed first the one who had been overlooked, the one who had waited the longest, the one who had no one to get him to the pool. The issue most in need of attention today is health care delivery. That's still the need. There's a large segment of the world's population, many within our own nation, whose medical services are at a primitive stage. That is where we begin. The just distribution of the resources we have been given is the first task. While we debate the future, we must achieve justice in the present. While we consider the novel, we must not overlook the common. What is the future of medicine? It depends on how we answer these questions. Shall we play God? No, but we have no excuse to avoid the responsibility of being God's co-workers in the task of managing the medical resources at our disposal. What shall be our guidelines? The acts of God show us the way. And there we see a God whose obsession is to serve human need. How do we define human life? God has created us bodily and with a freedom and individual uniqueness that requires special protection. Furthermore, we've been created as communal beings. Therefore, we advance the quality of human existence wherever we promote reconciliation or the capacity of one human being to have fellowship with another. Who shall decide? The decisions are so important and so complex that only our communal wisdom will be adequate. In finding ways to decide together, we become more like the community of humanity which God created us to be. What do we do first? Justice in healthcare delivery is the immediate task. While we tease our minds with the unique dilemmas of modern medicine, we must not overlook an ancient problem. The weak, the forgotten, the unpopular are not getting to the healing waters. Only as we see and follow the example of Christ will we hear him say to us, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." Let me think out loud about how I go about analyzing that. I begin by rejecting the notion that the process of cloning or any other process by which life might be created is by its very nature morally illegitimate. I reject the notion that as we have capacities and abilities to affect that which God has created and given to us, that before the fact we reject our responsibility to manage that, to participate with God in the creating of life. I think that the mistaken perspective that has led many of us to reach that conclusion that I'm rejecting is this God of the gaps notion. Namely, that if something that we have never done before is something that belongs, that is a quote, act of God, that is, it belongs beyond our realm of possibility and therefore forever is beyond our responsibility. The truth is that we are co-workers, and when new techniques arrive, we are responsible for using them. All right. But then the second thing I would say about cloning specifically is that almost all of the reasons for cloning that I have heard appear to me to be illegitimate. Almost all. For example, one of the illustrations that has been used by a lot, the notion has been, well, let us suppose that, you know, Einstein's in his last few weeks, and here we have an opportunity to create 24 Einsteins. Let's do it. Well, I reject that for several reasons. And the first one is that I view that as an assault upon the individuality and freedom of those who were created. Because of the structure, the social system, and the reason for their being is not to be themselves, but to be new Einstein. I reject it on the same grounds that I reject the notion of a friend of mine who's determined, she is determined that that 13-year-old of hers is going to be a concert pianist. He's got no say-so in it. He's going to be a concert pianist. That's what he was born to be. That's what he's going to be. And I would suggest that that is a flagrant violation of that child's freedom to be who he is, and that he must participate in deciding that. And there are many things in this area, cloning being a more dramatic example, in which the entire vision of the process is to create persons to be something other than which they can help determine. And so, and then for other reasons, I'm bothered because of the last point I made. I'm bothered by our kind of captivity to the novel that would suggest that the quickest and best way to get the bright contributing folks for the future is to clone some Einstein. But as a matter of fact, the quickest and the best and the most just way is adequate protein in the diet.